Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage takes the frustrations out of getting a mortgage by letting you safely share your financial information with the touch of a button. Get approved online in minutes at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, a Trump campaign shakeup, flooding and fire in Louisiana and California, Olympic gold, Ryan Lochte's tall tales, lies. On Sunday, Olympic swimmer Ryan Lochte told NBC that he and three other U.S. swimmers were robbed at gunpoint on their way home from a party early Sunday morning. Brazilian officials say his story is fabricated. They've got video. It doesn't look like Lochte's story.
Guy pulled out his gun. He cocked it, put it to my forehead, and he said, get down, and I was like, I put my hands up, I was like, whatever.
Bad poll numbers and Trump campaign changes. The fiery head of Breitbart News as CEO, Kellyanne Conway as his new campaign manager.
We're going to make sure Donald Trump is comfortable about it being in his own skin, that he doesn't lose that authenticity that you simply can't buy and a pollster can't give you.
Wildfire in California and historic flooding in Louisiana. Flood victim James Lane said he had moved north in the state for safety and then got hit again.
We actually lost everything in Katrina, came here, and 10 years later lost everything again.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Michael Crowley of Politico, Rachel Smolkin of CNN, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you make of the Trump campaign changes, maybe a cleanup at the Clinton Foundation, fire, flood, and Ryan Lochte? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington, Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Michael, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
Also with us from Washington is Rachel Smolkin, executive editor at CNN Politics. Rachel, great to have you.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Michael, and Rachel.
Rachel, what is going on with the Trump campaign? The very latest I see, I don't know if you've seen this, but Robert Costa at the Washington Post, it says a close friend tells him that Paul Manafort, now campaign chairman, has resigned. I don't know if that's confirmed yet. What is going on with the Trump campaign this week?
Well, it was quite a week for the Trump campaign. It is confirmed. The Trump campaign just put out a statement. So we have some breaking news this morning, as if the week had not been exciting enough. The Trump campaign statement says that Paul Manafort offered and that Donald Trump accepted his resignation from the campaign. So that caps a very busy political week for Donald Trump. In fact, maybe I shouldn't even say caps quite yet. But it was a week where we saw a lot of changes in the campaign, a surprising shakeup where, as you said, Steve Bannon, the executive chairman of the right-wing site, Breitbart News, came in and is now going to be chief executive. And Kellyanne Conway, who's a respected pollster, is campaign manager. So we saw Manafort first sidelined and now out. And in addition, we saw a very quick reboot for Donald Trump. We had quite a remarkable moment last night in which he expressed contrition, said that he regretted some of the things that he had said, particularly things where he had caused personal pain. Now, he did not get into which of those things he was referring to, but made kind of a blanket statement of regret, which we really have not seen him do in public in more than a year of campaigning.
Kelly, let's listen to a little bit of that, because there's so much here, a piece at a time. This was Trump on Tuesday in Wisconsin talking with WKBT, said he did not plan to change his behavior in the general election.
I am who I am. It's me. I don't want to change. Everyone talks about, oh, well, you're going to pivot. I don't want to pivot. I mean, you have to be you. If you start pivoting, you're not being honest with people.
I don't want to pivot, said Donald Trump. But there was this, as you say, last night, campaign rally in Charlotte. Said he regretted some things, didn't specify what he regretted, did not apologize exactly, but here he was.
Sometimes in the heat of debate and speaking on a multitude of issues, you don't choose the right words or you say the wrong thing. I have done that. And believe it or not, I regret it.
Okay, Rachel, there's a kind of mea culpa, and you say beyond that, what?
Beyond that, so we're just getting started here with the Trump week. Beyond that, he seemed much more comfortable in the speech than he has seen for a while. We've heard sort of the mantra of the week of let Trump be Trump, that he felt like he was being restrained too much. Maybe it didn't always come across as restraint, but he felt restrained when Paul Manafort was running things, and he really wanted to run the campaign his way. So we're seeing this push of let Trump be Trump. Now, it's Donald Trump, so it's hard to know if what we saw last night will sustain. And that's the major question moving forward. But he did seem much more fired up, much more like himself than perhaps he has in recent weeks in the speech last night.
Of course, putting Stephen Bannon in there is a big statement in itself. I mean, even Republicans kind of raising eyebrows this week. We heard Republican political analyst Todd Donkey was talking with my home station WBUR's Morning Edition this week. And Thursday, he said the addition of Breitbart's Steve Bannon to the Trump campaign is a sign that Trump will become just more fiery or maybe extreme in the future.
Hiring Bannon is a sign that Trump wants a flamethrower, not only to scorch his opponent, Hillary Clinton, but also the mainstream media and the Republican establishment. So Trump has turned to a propagandist who specializes in hate because Trump hates to lose.
There from Republican analyst Todd Domke. Rachel, what is driving all these moves? Is it the poll numbers? If so, what's happening?
I think it's a lot, the poll numbers. We know that Donald Trump is a candidate who pays close attention to poll numbers, and they certainly have not been good in recent weeks. He had a nice post-convention bounce and then really began to spiral after that. But as you say, you know, there was a lot of controversy around bringing in Steve Bannon, and it looked to everyone like this was an acknowledgement that we're going to see even more of a bare-knuckled outsider fight than we've seen before. And that nothing about Hillary Clinton will be off limits. And it was really interesting that because we in the media were sort of writing about this theme of scorched earth tactics, the very first thing that happened with the reboot was a Trump apology, showing once again, you really can't predict anything about the 2016 campaign. But I think all those elements are coming in together, and he's been struggling in the polls.
I mean, what a week. On the Clinton side, you have them kind of looking to clean up or button up the Clinton Foundation, saying they're going to change the way that works. Bill Clinton with a changing role that won't take contributions from foreign sources anymore. We'll look at that. On the Trump side, Paul Manafort now said to be out of the Trump campaign. We had this report this week. This was a little clip from Artem Sintik, the chief of Ukraine's anti-corruption bureau in Ukraine. He talked on Monday after Trump's campaign chair, Paul Manafort, appeared on a list showing cash payments of more than $12 million made by the political party of Ukraine's former pro-Russian president, Viktor Yanukovych, here interpreted by Euronews.
Regarding Mr. Manafort, his last name is mentioned in the so-called Black Ledger of the Party of Regions. And according to this list, more than $12 million was spent to cover expenses which were related to this person.
Michael Crowley, remind us of the era in which that might have been paid and what Paul Manafort was part of.
So Paul Manafort, who made his name as an American political consultant in the 70s, actually branched out, as many of these high-powered Washington lobbyists do, to where the real money is, which is foreign governments and politicians, particularly in countries where money sloshes around with without a lot of transparency or oversight. And in this case, I believe in around 2004, he starts to get involved in Ukrainian politics and becomes an advisor to a Ukrainian politician named Viktor Yanukovych. This is a man who became president of Ukraine and is the one who fled the country after the mass protests in early 2014, fled to Russia. He was sort of a on again, off again, in the end, on ally of Vladimir Putin. Manafort, to hear people over there tell it, sort of came in and gave him state-of-the-art Western U.S. political campaigning tips on how to look, how to be more polished, how to modify his message in different parts of the country, and appears to have made a huge amount of money. Incidentally, also started to do enormous business deals, which have gotten a little less attention. We can go into that later if you want. But basically, that's what gets you to these ledgers that are coming out now. It appears that you know, Manafort was taking these very, very large payments that seem to have been off the books. They look a little bit sketchy. It's not clear, but seems as though this may have been government money, which would be a big problem. On top of that, Tom, last thing I'll say, on a parallel track, we've been seeing stories break in the last couple of days, and I think this is probably what finally did him in, suggesting that Manafort was directing lobbying efforts for Ukraine's government in Washington, using kind of a shell go-between, quote-unquote, think tank based in Brussels to try to avoid registering as a foreign lobbyist and disclosing activities that he ought to have done. So you actually start to have a little bit of a legal implication going on here. It adds up to a pretty foul odor and the end of Paul Manafort and the Trump campaign, it seems.
Jack Beatty, that doesn't look great, particularly when Donald Trump has spoken so favorably about Vladimir Putin and the U.S. working with Russia. I mean, you want to talk about quid pro quos. We'll look at the whole, the $400 million that went to Iran and all that this week. Who knows? On the other hand, Jack, the Clinton Foundation has taken many, many, many millions from abroad, and they've taken steps this week to say, well, we're going to change that if Hillary Clinton is president.
Yes, at long last, an editorial in the Boston Globe called for that and this week, and they've decided to do it. It's a little late. In 2009, Secretary Clinton said that she would wall her job off from the foundation. The wall, as the Globe points out, was permeable, and there were at least efforts to work out some kind of pay to play. It didn't. What we know thus far, a case of a Lebanese Nigerian businessman, that doesn't seem to have been the case. He didn't make the connection with the U.S. ambassador to Lebanon, but there was that attempt. And, you know, you mentioned that a third of the contributions to the Clinton Foundation's, the largest contributions, were in fact from foreign governments.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news this hour. A Trump campaign shakeup, flooding and fire in Louisiana, California, Olympic gold, Ryan Lochte's tall tales. You can join us this hour. Do you expect a new and different Trump out of this? What about the Clinton Foundation front and the changes announced there? Are you with Donald Trump's foreign policy all out on ISIS somehow and extreme vetting on immigrants at home? And beyond that, what do you make of Russia now flying bombers out of Iran? What do you think of the little Syrian boy, dusty, bleeding, shell-shocked, and the reaction of the world to that photograph, that video, out of besieged Aleppo? Michael Crowley is with us, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Rachel Smolkin is here, executive editor at CNN Politics, and our own Jack Beatty. Trump says change is coming, made kind of an apology too, but at a campaign rally in Cleveland on Wednesday, Hillary Clinton said changes to his campaign would not change the candidate himself.
For anyone waiting for Donald Trump to suddenly become more responsible, remember what a great American, Maya Angelou, said. When someone shows you who they are, believe them.
But Trump talking in other new ways, kind of new ways, maybe this week. He, after the trouble in Milwaukee, the police shooting there and trouble in the streets afterward, he went to a rather white community, West Bend, Wisconsin, on Tuesday, 40 miles north of Milwaukee, and talked about the shooting death and the African-American community.
Our job is not to make life more comfortable for the rioter or the robber or the looter or the violent disruptor, of which there are many. Our job is to make life more comfortable for the African-American parent who wants their kids to be able to safely walk the streets and walk to school.
Donald Trump reaching out there in a way to African Americans, a new tone. Gabe in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Gabe, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. So it seems to me that what Trump has been doing these last couple weeks and now with this change is less about winning in November, but more about saving his brand. Because, you know, his name, Trump, is really what he's all about, and his business is very much dependent on that. And if it becomes a joke, which, you know, in some ways he is, it's really going to hurt him. So he's kind of gone back into the birther realm. You know, he's talking about rigged elections. He's bringing this guy from Breitbart in. He's sort of, you know, setting himself up, you know, still as that, you know, nationalist of the people so he can, you know, so he can survive after after this thing.
Gabe, it's an interesting observation. Rachel Smolkin, is his campaign in that much trouble at this point? When you look at the polls and the map of the country, that he would be strategizing a graceful exit, or at least an exit, maybe not graceful, but an exit that preserves his brand? Is that bad? I mean, I'm seeing these headlines saying Republicans are worried about losing the Senate on zero coattails or worse, and losses in the House. Is it that clear?
Well, it certainly doesn't look good right now. And there has been a lot of talk about, well, maybe he's making these changes exactly for that reason, to preserve his brand and look ahead after November. But I think it's really important to remember that right now it's August. There's still a fall campaign ahead of us. Polls show a snapshot in time. They are not predictive. And if he is able to reboot himself and sustain the energy and comfort and outsider campaigning that he showed last night, the race could look very different. It could change quickly. And the Clinton folks know that, which is why they've been trying so hard to keep their voters engaged and other Democrats engaged and not allow them to become complacent. Now, Trump said this week that we're going to call him Mr. Brexit. You're making the comparison. The polls were wrong, just like with Brexit. He's going to stage this dramatic comeback. He has a very steep hole to climb out of to make that happen. But again, it's possible. And I think we all have to remember that nothing in the 2016 campaign so far has gone as predicted.
Let's go to Diane in Summertown, Tennessee. Diane, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. I just wanted to say, remember that the leopard does not change its spots. And that's my comment.
Who are we talking about here, Diane?
Oh, we're talking about Donald Trump.
All right, all right. You're sort of making Hillary Clinton's point there. I appreciate your call. One more, Dawsonville, Georgia. Amanda, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I wanted to make a comment. You played a clip from Hillary, and she quoted Maya Angelou about when someone shows themselves, and then they compared it to Donald Trump. I think we need to be fair. And let's talk about Hillary's, what she showed. And she, there are obvious lies that she has told recently, that she told that she did not know anything about the emails, that she didn't know about any other servers. And then FBI Comey came back and, and said, well, obviously she did.
Amanda, we remember it well. Let me pick it up right there, if I may. Jack Beatty, we've got leopard spots all over the place here.
Yes, we have. But you know, as an empirical matter, no candidate for the presidency has lied as flagrantly as Donald Trump. That's the burden of a long piece by our friend S.V. Date in Huffington Post, talking to American historians. They can find no one who has lied as frequently as Trump.
For example, Jack.
For example, this week, his major speech on the Islamic State, Glenn Kessler, the fact checker of the Washington Post, fills 11 of my pages here with outright lies told by Trump in that speech and deceptions in the speech. The outright lies begin really with the "I was against the Iraq war before it happened." There is no evidence for that. There is evidence for the contrary. It's been corrected again and again. He keeps saying it. The deceptions, he criticizes Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama for the intervention in Libya. And doesn't tell us, and it's on tape, that he was in favor of that intervention. He is a demagogue. He lies just as other people breathe. And so, yes, Hillary has has consistently prevaricated about all sorts of things.
You're going to say and prevaricated for Hillary and lie for Donald Trump? Is that fair?
No, I will even say lies about Hillary. In fact, there was one this week where she said, "I'm the only candidate who, of all the people who ran for presidency this year, I'm the only one who said there'll be no raised taxes on the middle class." Every Republican virtually took that position. So that's an out-and-out lie.
Let's go to Anthony in Lexington, Kentucky. Anthony, you're on the air.
Yeah, I had a problem with, I'm African American, I had a problem with what Donald Trump was talking about in regards to riots and people, you know, looking out for making sure the looters are taken care of or rioters or whatever in regards to African American community and the and his focus on so-called parents being able to have their children walk to school safely.
Yeah.
You know, the actions that are taking place in the African American community with Black Lives Matters are not violent ones, and those are things that Donald Trump doesn't want to recognize or see because he's a bigot, and he has a bigot has that perspective is not really concerned about what's really going on in those communities. So that's pretty much my comment.
Anthony, I appreciate it. I appreciate it very much. Let me get one more from Nashville, Tennessee. Carl is calling. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Well, you know, Tom, I'm 45. And I still like the same football team I liked when I was 5 years old. I still eat the same foods. The point is this. He's a 70-year-old man, meaning Donald Trump. And it irritates me to no end when I hear newscasters or reporters say he's changing, he's making a change. No, he's not. He's the same sociopath who lied about being against the war, even though he's on tape saying he was for it. The same sociopath who said that basically, you know, Second Amendment people should assassinate a future president of the United States. He's the same racist who had discriminated against black people with his housing. The same racist who called for the death penalty for five young teenagers who were eventually found not guilty years later. He's the same womanizer, the same sexist, who said that Megyn Kelly was on her period because she asked him, how dare she ask him a question?
Carl, can he pull out a black vote, do you think? Some? Any?
Well, we're here, and I'm getting to that as well. And to my Republican friends, you know, you getting a guy that's coming to your party from Breitbart who says racist, bigotist things, just blatant. One of the quotes that come from there was, quote, this, saying that black people, no, she said that American, no, British settlers built America. Saying that slaves built America is like saying that cows built America. So basically, he and the Republican Party has always been, well, at least for the past 50 years, has been this racist, bigoted place and home for racism. And they expect in one speech for black people to vote for him. It's insulting at best, condescending at worst. And he is what he is. The Republican Party and Donald Trump are what they are.
There's Carl, no we've got it. It doesn't sound like you're going to be much of a target for Donald Trump whatsoever. I appreciate your call and, Anthony, yours as well on those Trump comments out of West Bend, Indiana, and more. Of course, there was his big foreign policy speech this week as well. He called for weeding out what he called terror support networks in the U.S. viciously, if necessary, he said. And he called for strict new loyalty tests for immigrants coming into this country.
In the Cold War, we had an ideological screening test. The time is overdue to develop a new screening test for the threats we face today. I call it extreme vetting. I call it extreme vetting.
I want to look at that, how that might work. Vice President Joe Biden went to town on Trump's comments about dictators over the years, said Trump praises dictators.
He's even showered praise on Saddam Hussein, one of the vilest dictators of the 20th century, a man who repeatedly back terror attacks against Israel because he was supposedly, the reason he admires him, he was a killer of terrorists. That's why he likes Saddam. He would have loved Stalin. He would have loved Stalin.
Jack Beatty, who's over the top here?
Joe Biden. I think that's over the top. I saw a spokesperson for the Trump campaign saying, wait a minute, if Trump had said something like this, it would be leading all the newscasts. I mean, you don't make statements like that. Substitute Hitler and you see the power and really emotionality and recklessness of that statement.
And Michael Crowley, let me come to you on Trump's foreign policy speech and his call for extreme vetting, kind of an all-out focus on ISIS abroad. judging allies by how well they join in that effort, and then extreme vetting of who comes into this country at home. Start with the ISIS side. Has he put out dramatic new initiatives beyond what, let's say, the Obama administration has exercised?
No, Tom, I'm not hearing dramatic new initiatives, particularly on the kind of military political side of the campaign against ISIS. You know, for one thing, notably, he's not talking about, you know, large numbers of ground troops reinvading the region. A lot, and you know, to the extent that he emphasized, as you just mentioned, this idea of working really closely with countries in the region that share our determination to destroy ISIS and not getting bogged down on other issues with them. I think the Obama administration is already facing criticism that it's looked the other way at, for instance, severe human rights violations and repression in Egypt, because General Sisi, who is running that country now, has been a strong ally against ISIS. We have soft-pedaled a little bit the crackdown in Turkey because we've needed Turkish assistance, and there's a very important air base in Turkey that allows us to conduct airstrikes against ISIS. The Obama administration is already kind of doing this. And by the way, in the middle of all this, I mean, Trump's speech had a lot of jumbled, contradictory components. He took a shot at Obama for not being more critical of Egypt on human rights when he gave a big speech in Cairo in 2009. But now Trump seems to be saying that we shouldn't care about this really breathtaking crackdown in Egypt because Egypt is a strong ally. So I just don't see a fundamental shift. To me, it's rhetorical.
What about the extreme vetting side? Can we put up a finer mesh net about people coming to this country effectively and with that lower the risk of terrorism?
So in theory, we can, but practically it's really hard to do. It's going to be, among other things, extremely expensive. You need to have a lot of people who are examining individual visa applications and debating whether to approve these people. So for starters, you're going to have to spend a lot of money and grow the federal government, which is something Trump doesn't like. You know, there is a little bit of historical precedent, particularly during the kind of, anti-communist scare in the Cold War, particularly early in the Cold War. To this day, people still have to check a box, I believe, saying whether or not they've ever been a member of the Communist Party. And there was more attention on, given to that, you know, to sort of ideological tests during that period. But in reality, people can lie and they can continue to lie even if you crack down more carefully. I don't find a lot of people who specialize in this field thinking that what Trump's talking about is very practical or effective. And, you know, finally, Tom, this all comes down to a balance of what kind of country you want to have. Do you want to, you know, will you accept some level of risk from having a pluralistic society with relatively open borders that help you in all kinds of other ways, from economics to the nature of your society to the image of your country? Or do you want to, you know, push risk down to the smallest possible level at the cost of those other things? Trump is clearly arguing for the latter, but again, it's not even clear that he is going to be able to reduce risk significantly if he has a chance to implement this vision.
Rachel Smolkin, we just got half a minute before the break, but is this look at how much time we're spending talking about Donald Trump. Is this working for Hillary Clinton? I mean, she's out there, she's on the trail, but she's not making the kind of big statements or proposals that would necessarily get her headlines. Is that a strategy? Is it working?
Well, it's certainly working right now. That doesn't necessarily mean it will continue to work. She's letting Trump take the limelight. It's also important, though, to remember that she has her own baggage, and these issues of the foundation and the email server go to trust, and she's got to overcome that with voters.
Support for On Point with Tom Ashbrook and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage brings the mortgage process into the 21st century. Forget about digging through stacks of paperwork. This completely online process lets you safely share your bank statements and pay stubs with the touch of a button. Using a phone or tablet, you can get approved for purchase or refinance in just a few minutes. Check out Rocket Mortgage at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week at the Olympics in Rio, U.S. women took a historic sweep with gold, silver, and bronze, all three in the 100-meter hurdles. Silver medalist Nia Ali watched as teammate Christy Castlin got bronze to complete the sweep.
When we looked up at the screen and we were like, did we do it? Did we do it? And then we saw Christy's name come up and it was like, yes. It was perfect.
Yeah, pretty great. The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore ends its 1.5-year run on Comedy Central this week. The network said bad ratings for the only African-American host in late-night comedy. Here was Wilmore on Monday.
On the plus side, I must say, our show going off the air has to only mean one thing. Racism is solved. We did it.
We did it, and more maybe not. And news legend John McLaughlin passed away at age 89. He hosted the long-running political affairs show, The McLaughlin Group.
Yes or no, Pat?
Wrong.
No.
Hello.
Yes.
No.
The answer is yes. Bye-bye.
Yes, yes, no, bye-bye. Okay. You can join the conversation this hour. We're looking at the Trump campaign shakeup, flooding and fire in Louisiana, California. We've got to turn to, of course, Olympic gold and Ryan Lochte's tales. Are you in the fire zone this week in California? Are you in the flood? And what are we seeing in California and Louisiana? What are we seeing in this Ryan Lochte story? What do you make of those of Russia now flying bombers out of Iran? That image of the 5-year-old Syrian boy Omran Dakhnish got attention all over the place this week. Pulled from rubble after his home in Aleppo was destroyed by an airstrike on Wednesday. In video and the photos, he sits in an ambulance, his cartoon character T-shirt covered in dust, left side of his face bloody. He's still, very still, despite all that chaos around him. Here's some video of the scene posted by the Aleppo Media Center. And who will ever forget the image of that boy and all that chaos? Meanwhile, Russian bombers, which are headed to bomb Syria, now flying out of Iran. Here's Syed Hossein Hosseini, senior Iranian lawmaker, on Wednesday talking about Iran's decision to open their military bases to Russia, interpreted here by CCTV.
Russia is one of the countries who are sincere in fighting against terrorism. So is Iran. We are cooperating with each other with a common goal. Iran is ready to support Russia in many aspects for achieving this goal, including opening military facilities to Russian forces.
Michael Crowley, what is the significance of Iran letting Russia fly bombers out of its territory?
Well, Tom, it's not what you would call a game changer. It doesn't mean that the Syrian conflict has taken some dramatic new turn. But there are a couple of things worth noting here. For one, it illustrates, well, as a practical matter, it makes it easier for Russia to conduct the airstrikes it has been conducting since last fall on behalf of the Assad regime to try to keep Assad in power. And Iran is also an ally of Assad. So these three countries have formed a kind of axis to try to keep the Assad regime in power. And they say to fight terrorists like ISIS and an al-Qaeda affiliated group that recently changed its name, although there are also U.S.-backed relatively moderate rebels in the conflict. So it's become a little logistically easier for the Russians to do this. What it really does is solidifies in a way this growing Russian influence in the region that we're seeing as a result of Russia's involvement in this conflict. That's something that makes American strategic planners nervous. What is Russia's long-term plan for the Middle East, and is it something how big of a concern is it for the United States? But I think, you know, most importantly, what should people take away from this? It's that, you know, Russia is there in this conflict to stay for the foreseeable future. They are very invested in making sure that Assad survives. It's going to be very difficult to dislodge him. That is the goal of United States policy at this point, at least officially. But, you know, Russia just is not backing down, is not showing any sign of impatience. You may recall that several months ago, Vladimir Putin announced that he was withdrawing much of his forces from Syria, and there was a kind of mission accomplished attitude. I literally heard that on a Russian television station, mission accomplished. That was really bogus. Russia is still deeply involved. And the U.S. is really not a lot closer to figuring out a policy solution that will bring an end to this conflict that Secretary of State John Kerry has been seeking for months and months now.
What about the $400 million in cash delivered midnight flight to Iran by the U.S. before those hostages were released earlier this year? It was, I guess, a payment on $1 billion-plus that decades ago Iran had given to the U.S. for arms under the Shah. Then the Shah fell. We still had the money. It was supposed to go back.
part of it in cash before they came out. It's being called ransom by critics of the Obama regime. How do you see it, Michael?
Well, it's a complicated one. This deal was in the context of the giant nuclear deal that happened last July that listeners will remember. So there was a kind of great settling of accounts between the U.S. and Iran that included the nuclear deal, prisoner swaps. We also released a bunch of Iranian prisoners and then the this money. So what we learned this week, although we knew that Iran was getting this money that had been tied up from the arms deal, 30 plus years ago, as you just described, what we found out this week was that the timing of this money seemed to be linked to the departure of the Americans from Iran. A State Department spokesman who was being pressed on this question admitted in a way that the U.S. government had not done before that the money was not released to the Iranians until the Americans were released. So it felt it looks pretty quid pro quo. Now, is it ransom? You start getting into what is the exact definition. I mean, we owed the Iranians this money anyway. The Obama administration says we were going to have to pay it eventually. So we're not coming up with a sack of money just because they have these people, which is sort of the traditional idea of a ransom. On the other hand, it does sound like the Iranians, you know, had the power to keep those Americans in their country if we weren't going to fork over the dough. And there was a kind of a synchronicity to that transaction. So that does look like a traditional ransom. Like so many things, Tom, this may be kind of a Rorschach test. And the last thing I'll say is, as a political matter, Republicans are going to pound this. It's a good line for Donald Trump on the stump. He's not going to get into the nuances of it. It will put the Obama administration on the defensive. And Hillary Clinton, who played a big role in the Iran negotiations early on, although was not still in government at the time of this transaction, will probably find herself answering some questions about it.
I don't think we're going to hear the word synchronicity from Republicans, but ransom. Ransom. Maybe so. I really want to turn to California and especially to Louisiana. I mean, I know the fires have been terrible in California and burning like crazy there east of Los Angeles now in San Bernardino even now. It wasn't so long ago we were out there to one of a member station in the public radio network. We know that region and we can picture what's going on. But the same with Louisiana. Lots of listeners there and we know it has been really, really tough. And for a while, maybe not the attention they needed. Here was the governor of Louisiana, John Bel Edwards, at a press conference. This is all the way last Saturday. He said everyone who's been asked to evacuate should because these are unprecedented floods.
What we know is we have record levels of flooding along rivers and creeks. And because these are record floods, we don't know how wide the water is going to get in those areas. We don't. This is unprecedented, so we don't have records that we can go back and see who all is going to be impacted.
Unprecedented, the word that keeps coming up. We had this week on the show the state climatologist of Louisiana, who pointed out to us that nine different weather stations in Louisiana had reported rainfall that exceeded 1,000-year storms. Storms that are only supposed to happen once in 1,000 years. And they had them at nine stations around Louisiana. Since May of last year, eight or nine 500-year-plus storms across the South. That's in just over a year. And we know that Louisiana has really suffered in this last week. Jennifer in New Orleans, thank you for calling, Jennifer. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am in New Orleans. I am from Baton Rouge, and my entire family lives there. Eight or nine out of 11 have flooded. Most have lost everything. I am in New Orleans just for today. I have been running my washing machine constantly, trying to salvage some clothes so people have things to wear while we clean out. If you include my immediate family spouses, we are at about 30 plus in lost homes. When they say it came fast, it came so fast. Within 2 hours, the water crested a high road a mile away from my mother's house and was a foot in her house.
Wow.
She got out with my father's ashes The lockbox with the insurance and her iPad so she could communicate, and that is it. And we are so grateful.
What are they seeing, Jennifer? What is your aunt seeing there?
My aunt has a casket in her backyard. One of them. That's one aunt.
A casket because of the way things are buried in Louisiana? They just got uncovered and floated off?
Yes. Another aunt lives a few houses down from her, so they are all throughout that neighborhood. They got a lot of water. They started flooding last Friday. My mom started flooding Saturday night. My cousin started flooding, I think, Monday. One cousin who started flooding Monday or Sunday, I believe, was in the house on Tuesday. He had like 2 feet. Then the sheriff came and evacuated them because it was rising again.
Jennifer,
I believe another cousin didn't start flooding till Wednesday.
Jennifer, how are you thinking about this? How's your family thinking about it? 8 or 9 out of 11 flooded out, and we know how rough that is. I mean, you had Katrina, you had Rita, now this, and this up further north than before, and very, very difficult to deal with. How are you and your family thinking about what's going on here and your relationship to flooding in Louisiana?
Honestly, right now we are very much on the autopilot. Right now, our main goal is to gut the houses, to beat the mold. This is different from Katrina because Katrina, we were locked out. I also have family in New Orleans. So, and for Katrina, I was living in Baton Rouge. So I did this 12 years ago with family and friends and my grandparents at the time in New Orleans. It's much harder for me because I'm closer to this family. And my mother's house was purchased 6 months before I was born.
Yeah.
So I have a lot more memories. But by the time we got into the house in Katrina, there was really nothing to salvage, or there's very little to salvage.
Yep.
The water receded relatively quickly within about 48 hours for some of us. So there is time to, you know, there are things that can be saved. So what we decided as a group, because there are so many of us and such limited resources, is you go into the house you own, you get what you can, we get our groups together, and we start gutting. So my mother's house, if not by the end of day today, by tomorrow, should be completely gutted, and then we move on to the next one.
Jennifer, we've got it. You're in the here and now, maybe a little bit on autopilot, getting out there with dad's ashes and a lockbox and an iPad. Jack Beatty, I mean, this is a real battering, and records broken all over the place, and people starting to think, how do we handle this? We don't hear a lot of reflection of this on the campaign trail. Talk about what may be behind these natural disasters.
Well, no, you're right. I mean, Hillary Clinton has mentioned global warming, but it's not prominent. And since it's such a huge issue, that's too bad. And of course, Donald Trump has said that it's a Chinese plot to get us to deindustrialize. And meanwhile, a report, I only saw it in headline form on television, but one report just came out this week that said by the year 2100, Jennifer's story is going to be repeated in cities up and down the East Coast as they become effectively unlivable. Because of rising seas.
Our hearts with everybody in Louisiana and, of course, California as well. We can't go without looking at the Olympics. Congratulations to so many who have done so well there from the U.S. and well beyond. Usain Bolt, just incredible this week. But then came that Ryan Lochte story. NBC talked with him on Sunday. Here's how he described what happened. Said robbed at gunpoint on the way home from a party.
I was like, we didn't do anything wrong. So I'm not getting down on the ground. And then the guy pulled out his gun, he cocked it, put it to my forehead, and said, get down. And I was like, I put my hands up, I was like, whatever. He took our money, he took my wallet.
Now Brazil saying that was a fantastical story, that it stained the reputation of Brazil. Lochte out with a statement today, I want to apologize for my behavior last week, and he said, for not being more careful and candid about how I described the events of that early morning, for my role in taking the focus away from the many athletes fulfilling the dreams of participating in the Olympics. Tony in Nashville. Tony, you're on. Our time is short. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. From the Peanut Gallery, I don't think highly of Lochte. He appears to be a pompous, disrespectful person and makes for a poor American delegate in a foreign country. As an attorney, however, I believe there's enough truth to his story that the group of four deserves some defense while understanding they were not without fault. In the United States, self-help for property damage using a gun and money demand could be charged as robbery. Otherwise, there would be no civil court, and anyone wronged would use self-help instead of resorting.
You mean, even
to
if they did vandalize the bathroom, even if they did vandalize the bathroom, we've seen the video of a security guard who appears to be pointing a gun at the window or through the window of the taxi that they were in. You think that's close enough to what Lochte was describing, to say, gun to my forehead?
They were pulled out of their taxi. They were told to get on the ground at gunpoint. There were no police lights. Money was given to the people or person with the gun. Enough of the story checks out while understanding that Lochte didn't tell the whole story, and, you know, they were essentially engaged in bad behavior. However, you know, by the book, it would appear that a robbery did occur. And again, enough of his story checks out.
There's one attorney's view from Nashville, Tennessee today. Tony, I appreciate that. Rachel, do you think that's the way Ryan Lochte is going to be remembered?
I think that this finally rivaled the 2016 campaign for jaw-dropping twists and turns, and unfortunately he will be remembered for this incident, and it took a lot of attention away from athletes like Simone Biles, who just had incredible performances at the games.
Unbelievable. Simone Biles and right on down, great performances by American athletes, and really, once again, from right around the world, it is, talk about jaw-dropping, it is just amazing to see what beautiful athleticism is displayed there. I want to thank all three of you for being with us this week. Rachel Smolkin, executive editor at CNN Politics. Thank you so much for joining us, Rachel.
Thank you for having me.
Michael Crowley, senior foreign affairs correspondent for Politico. Thanks for being here, Michael.
Always a pleasure, Tom.
And Jack Beattie, thank you as always to you, sir.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. We're on Twitter at On Point Radio. I'm at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.